So my name is Erkay Savaş. Thank you for the introduction. I'm with the Sabancı University, which is located in Istanbul, Turkey. So it's kind of a new university, probably you don't know it. You haven't heard of anything about Sabancı University. It's kind of a Rockefeller of Turkey. It's kind of a family, very, very rich family in Turkey. So they founded this university. So today I'm going to talk about these unified architectures for efficient and also compact crypto processing, because it's not only efficient, it's also compact. So the idea is a very simple one. What we would like to do here is that we would like to unify or do arithmetic, different type of arithmetic and different type of mathematical structures in the single database. So the idea is very simple. So can we do it? Okay, I will show that in this talk that we can really do it. Okay, and also the overhead is not too much to combine all these different type of arithmetic operation in a single data path. So I will talk, and this is the outline of my talk. And so I will start with the giving the research motivation. So why we are doing this this research, and I will give brief introduction to public key cryptography, because to say that we are interested to speed up the public key crypto operations. So afterwards I will give an introduction to unified arithmetic, and I will talk about the different variations of the unified arithmetic, like high radix multiplication or dual radix multiplication, because the multiplication operation is one of the most important arithmetic operation, right? So this means that we are kind of going to epitomize the unified arithmetic in a specific case of multiplication in different, mathematical structures. And this support, because we showed that, you can, provide some support for ternary extension field arithmetic as well, because these, fields are especially important for pairing-based cryptography, which is kind of, becoming more and more popular recently. I will give some implementation results showing that, well, there are really some, advantages in this, in unified architectures, and I will give, conclude my talk, given some, directions for future research. So the first, the motivation, why we are doing this, because for the compatibility, meaning that we would like to, of course, the first thing is that we would like to design some crypto coprocessor or crypto accelerator, so this means that we would like to, provide, support, for fast or efficient arithmetic in different mathematical structures like finite fields, groups, or rings. Okay, it is applicable. The idea here is that saving in area means that, for example, you can have, in order to support different type of arithmetic and different mathematical structures, you may have separate data paths, and all data paths are kind of optimized for specific arithmetic. But of course, if you unify all these different operations in a single data path, what you can do, you are going to save, in area, meaning that in terms of number of gates. But of course, you are going to have some sort of, the overhead in time. Critical path delay probably is going to, increase. But we are going to show that this overhead is kind of insignificant, and we are going to show this, using this product of time area metric to show that this is, insignificant. And the last, motivation is the algorithm agility, meaning that, for example, if one of the algorithms, like, for example, N-true turn out to be, weak or broken, you can always switch to, for example, elliptic curve crypto algorithm to save the phase, continue in securing your information. So public key cryptography, I'm not going to give, this rudimentary information about the public key cryptography. I just put up this, slide to show that we are interested in, speeding up the public key crypto operations, even though there have been some attempts to unify, some architectures for symmetric key cryptography. For example, doing the, different type of symmetric key algorithm, block cipher algorithms in the same data path. So when we look at the public key cryptography in use, you will see that there are a lot of different type of public key cryptography algorithms. RSA is one of them. And this public key crypto algorithm is based on some hard problem, like in the case of RSA, integer factorization is the hard problem. And is a, you know, very similar, or the cousin of RSA is what's called Rabin scheme. They are not the same thing, actually. And the Rabin scheme is based on the, you know, the hard problem of square root of modulo composite number. So actually, these two, you know, their problems are kind of equivalent, you know, or reducible to each other. So the second kind of the public key crypto operation based on discrete logarithm-based algorithms, which is, you know, defined over some finite groups, like Diffie-Hellman key exchange, El-Gamal encryption, or El-Gamal, you know, signature algorithm, or digital signature algorithm as well. So, and one of the recently popular, you know, public key crypto algorithms, elliptic curve cryptography algorithms we can have. Again, we are, you know, our hard problem is, again, discrete logarithm over the groups of finite groups of the elliptic curves. So we can, you know, define anything, you know, we define for the, you know, discrete logarithm based algorithm in the elliptic curve domain as well. For example, we can have elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman exchange, elliptic curve digital signature algorithm, etc. And finally, you know, our one of the important things is that this pairing based cryptography. So this is one of the, you know, points of interest for us, because we would like to, you know, support the, you know, pairing operation in our unified architecture. Of course, you can extend, you know, this public key cryptographic algorithms. For example, there have been one attempt to unify the n-true arithmetic into the, you know, in this same data pad. But I'm not going to talk about this. So RSA is the most popular one, maybe the oldest one. It has been, you know, used, and it is invented by Rivas Shamir Edelman in 1977. It was patented, but patents expired, so this means that we can freely use it based on the integer factorization problem. So when you look at the, you know, RSA encryption, the encryption or signature generation or signature verification operation, you will see that you basically do a what is called a modular exponentiation operation, or exponentiation operation in a finite ring, okay, as Dr. Koch just explained about this. But of course, in turn, you know, this modular exponentiation operations are, you know, what is just repeated multiplication operation in this finite ring. So basically, in RSA, you do multiplication. Most of the time, you are, you know, spending on doing this multiplication operation. So the multiplication operation is an important, so this is why the multiplication is our focus. If you look at this discrete logarithm-based crypto system, you will see the same thing. This time, you are doing exponentiation over a finite field. I'm sorry, the finite group, I guess, right? G is here, is the primitive. Again, the multiplication operation is an important one. Elliptic curve cryptography is proposed for cryptographic use in 1985 by Neil Kobritz and Victor Miller independently. They don't know, you know, they have been working on the same thing. So, but of course, I didn't know this, that everybody's saying so. But of course, the elliptic curves are kind of a, you know, very old topic, and people are, you know, mathematicians have been working on this elliptic curve cryptography, you know, at least 150 years. And so, most important, you know, feature of elliptic curve cryptography, it's very suitable for constrained devices, meaning that, you know, resource constrained devices, there are not many time, not much, you know, area, not much energy or power, and etc.
Is that because the humans are shorter for elliptic curves, or is it because they actually get implemented
in a better way? The most important thing is that the key length is shorter. So that is the idea. Okay, because for example, if you are, you know, working with a, for example, in a mobile device, for example, you would like to send a signature over the, for example, a, you know, a wireless environment. So this means that, I mean, your signature, for example, should be short. This is very important. So that I think most distinguishing fact, you know, is that the key length and the signature lengths are shorter than when it compared to RSA cryptography. And when it comes to implementation, I don't know. I don't know whether you can, you know, implement elliptic curve cryptography using fewer number of gates. I don't know. I mean, that depends, I guess. But that depends on the implementation. But what is important here is that if you use 160-bit key length in elliptic curve cryptography, it is cryptographically, you know, as secure as 1024-bit RSA. And what is more important, that ECC, you know, scales better in terms of security, because when you double the key length in the cryptography, you have to quadruple the, you know, the key length in the RSA. So this means that this shows that the attackers are going to be more important in the future, although the RSA seems to be more important in today. So again, we are going to do arithmetic. I mean, what we would look like to do here is they would like to do what kind of operation we are, you know, performing in the elliptical cryptography. And basically, you know, whether it is a software or hardware implementation, of course, that depends on the, you know, the specific implementation, but most of the time you are spending doing, you know, multiplication operation in one of these fields. Okay? So, I mean, according to my personal, you know, observation, it's like at least 70% you spend on doing multiplication, you know, in a typical elliptical implementation. And the finite field here, in GFQ, which over which we construct elliptic curves, is kind of, you know, could be different. Think here, Q is a power of P, is a power of, yeah, a prime number, K power of prime number. So in alternatives, you mean you can use prime fields, K is one. You can use binary extension fields where the characteristic is two. And you can use prime extension fields where, yeah, this is a kind of a more generic form. And you can use ternary extension fields where the characteristic is three. And, you know, people kind of propose different implementations, you know, for each of these, you know, fields where you can do elliptical cryptography most efficiently. And finally, this is one of our, you know, latest works, because we would like to, you know, support the pairing-based cryptography, specific identity-based encryption methods. And so what is identity-based encryption? I'm not going to go into too much detail, technical detail about identity-based encryption, but what I would say that this is a new kind of public key cryptography algorithm, and public key can be any string, like your email, your name, or any descriptive name for the, you know, intended recipient. So this means that intended recipient doesn't have to be, you know, for example, you know, a specific third person. It could be some role, for example, you assume. You can say, okay, at 15 o'clock, I will send, you know, this guy to system administrator. Only the system administrator can, you know, decrypt this, you know, message at 15 p.m., for example, 15 o'clock, okay? So this is what happens with the identity-based encryption. So the most, they claim that this is, there is no need for certificates. Actually, the anonymity is also, you know, important in certain applications, because, you know, when you think of a classical public key cryptography, you will see that, you know, within a certificate you have your own identity and you have your public key. So there is a binding between your identity and the public key. Once you give the certificate, you just lose your anonymity. So this means that, well, sometimes you do not want to do that. For example, especially in location-based services, you do not want to give out your identity. Sometimes you would like to hide, okay? So I think for this kind of applications, identity-based encryption is especially useful. So this is how much I'm going to tell about the identity-based encryption. I'm going to tell it's an important and emerging type of, different type of public key cryptography. So here, most important, because again, we are going to do arithmetic, we are going to support this kind of arithmetic in our unified, you know, architecture. So what we do, most important, you know, operation in identity-based encryption is what's called a bilinear mapping. I mean, you can, you know, I think in the morning, you know, Luca gave us a very nice, you know, overview what kind of pairing functions you can define over the two curves. So we have whale pairing and tape pairing. And the same thing here is that, as you have seen in the morning talk, you will say that this is resource consuming, okay? So it takes too much time, too much area, and too much energy, and et cetera. So what we would like to do to support this kind of, you know, function within our, you know, our hardware. And especially when you are using tape pairing, these ternary extension fields become important. So now I came to do my point, actually. What is that, you know, unified arithmetic? As I said before, unified arithmetic, to do different type of, you know, arithmetic operations in different, you know, finite fields or mathematical structures in the same, you know, unified architecture, in a single unified architecture. So what kind of automatic structures we kind of, you know, support in our unified. So this means that prime fields, or it could be, you know, rings, or finite groups as well. Binary extension fields and ternary extension fields for IBC schemes. When you look at these different, you know, fields, you will see that all of these, you know, mathematical structures are different from each other. So why they different? Okay, they have dissimilar properties and etc. Therefore, you can, you know, exploit some of the, you know, properties of certain extension field or X, for example. You can come up with a different implementation, a very fast implementation. Okay, because of this dissimilarity. For example, you can use optimal normal base here. You can do very fast inversion and, you know, squaring operation. But we are not interested in that part. We are going to be interested in the similarities, you know, among these, you know, different fields. We are going to sacrifice this, you know, specialized hardware. So, when we say unified arithmetic, what are the requirements of the unified arithmetic? You should have single data path, unified data path, and a single control with some overhead, probably. And this overhead comes as, you know, the overhead in the area and the overhead in the, you know, time complexity is like, for example, critical path delay of the data path. And of course, this should be, you know, insignificant, this overset. And I'm going to show that these are insignificant using this product of time area metric. So, what makes possible to do, you know, arithmetic in different fields within the same single data path? Because there are some similarities. The way you do arithmetic, the way you represent the elements of these finite fields, because I'm going to start with this, you know, unified arithmetic to support these two fields. The first one is that you basically represent the elements of these fields in the same way in the hardware. So this means that binary strings, nothing more. Okay, and also when you look at the algorithms, you will see that the same algorithm, you know, almost work, you know, for both, you know, fields, prime fields and binary extension. We said the steps are the same, but within the steps, you have some, you know, different. You do different type of, you know, arithmetic, but steps are the same. And using the same control logic, you can just unify these algorithms within the same, you know, data path. So this means that because of this observation, and we concluded that, you know, unified arithmetic is possible and feasible and also, you know, useful. So let's look at what kind of operations, especially because, you know, our former, you know, previous focus was in epochal cryptography. We took a look at the different operations, addition. It's kind of a simple, you know, and you don't do too much here. There is multiplicative inversion you can do. It is extremely resource, you know, consuming in terms of time and area, etc. But, you know, fortunately, you know, you can avoid most of the inversion operations in LP-curve cryptography. But as I said before, it is possible to, you know, construct a unified inverter as well. I did it before several times. I mean, there are some publications on this. And our focus is going to be about multiplication GFP and multiplication in binary extension fields. This is the basically the our focus, because, you know, the multiplication in those fields are expensive in terms of area, time, energy consumption, and whatever, but we cannot avoid them, and we have to perform these multiplication operations. How are we going to do the, you know, multiplication operation? And in the previous talk, it has been mentioned that the Montgomery, you know, multiplication algorithm is one of the most efficient ones. And actually, we have Montgomery multiplication operation for prime fields and also binary extension fields. And we have, you know, found a Montgomery multiplication operation for ternary, you know, fields as well. But the steps are the same. It's no big deal, because go from, you know, one Montgomery multiplication algorithm, you know, to another one. So the most distinguishing, you know, factor of the Montgomery multiplication is faster, because it replaces division by simple shift operation. This is the very big idea. But there are also some other subtle, you know, advantages of using Montgomery multiplication. But I'm kind of reading, skipping this part. Suitable for unified design, meaning that you can define the Montgomery arithmetic for, because we have, not only we have Montgomery multiplication, we have Montgomery inversion as well, okay? So this means that you can just, you know, come up with the same type of algorithm for, you know, multiplication in different fields. Scalability is an important, for example, whenever you would like to, you know, increase the precision, it is possible to do so in the Montgomery multiplication. And there is some parallelism within the algorithm, and therefore we can do some pipelining operation here. So this is the Montgomery multiplication operation. This is the most simplistic one. So instead of, you know, for example, for this is the definition for GFP. Instead of, you know, the idea here is that to multiply AB mod P. But instead it just, you know, compute A times B times R to the power of minus 1 mod P. And Dr. Koch, you know, just showed us how to get rid of this, you know, R. R here is that is a k power of 2 modulo p. K is the number of bit size in the modulus here, in the prime number. But of course, you do not have to, you know, choose this specific value for R. You can choose different type of, you know, different powers of 2 as, you know, R, because some of them are especially important. I'm going to, you know, it will bring some additional advantages if you choose R in a different fashion here. So as you see here is that we have a big loop here. So what we do basically here is that we just scan, you know, the bits of the multiplier AI. Depending whether it is 0 or 1, we just add B, the multiplicand, to the partial result, and then we just shift the partial result one bit to the, you know, right. And so this this simple multiplication tells that, you know, this division is possible without losing, you know, bit, because if C is, you know, as a result of the step 3, if C is an odd number, you can just add, you know, for example, the modulus to this odd number so that it becomes even, and you can just shift it without losing any precision. So just, you know, remember these two steps of the Montgomery multiplication algorithm, but this is a full precision algorithm, meaning that we use the whole, you know, the multiplicand. This is not that scalable. I will show in a moment. And in the original algorithm, we have this, you know, final subtraction. But if you choose, for example, R is 2 to the power of k plus 2 or 3, so you can get rid of this final, you know, subtraction as well. So this means that you can just assume that this final subtraction is not there anymore. Okay? So why it is important to get rid of this, you know, final subtraction? Because of the two problems. It costs some time. And also, we do not have this final subtraction in the, you know, Montgomery multiplication for the, you know, binary extension field here. So if you look at this one, so you see that the steps of the algorithms are almost identical. And there are basically two differences. The first one is division by x, but division by x is the same as the division by 2, same operation. And the other difference is that instead of an integer operation, we have an XOR operation here. So we can say that, well, addition operation requires some carry propagation, but this XOR operation doesn't require carry propagation. What you can do here is that if you do, for example, integer addition using carry save adders, you do not have to propagate the carries. And so this means that, I mean, two, you know, algorithms becomes basically the same thing, okay? So, well, I'm going to tell what you have to do. So, because of the, you know, get rid of this carry propagation operation in Montgomery multiplication or addition operation, so we use this, you know, CSA representation. This is a redundant representation, because what we do here is that we represent, you know, an integer using the, you know, sum of two other integers, sum and carry part. So what we do here is that when we are doing the addition in GFP mode, I'm going to tell that GFP mode or GF, the binary extension mode. So what you do here is that you store the, you know, the carries in this part, in this integer, and your result is going to be in this form, carry and sum part. So of course, if you would like to get the, you know, non-redundant form, so you have to have a, you know, a carry propagation adder, as we will see later. But I mean, you do not really have to do it this way. Scalability is important. As I said before, in the original algorithm, it says that, okay, in one step, you know, in one step, in one clock cycles, you add the whole multiplicand to the partial result. You do not have to do this. What you can do, you can divide the multiplicand into words, and the length of the word, is depends on your, you know, on your choice. Okay, what you can do in one clock cycle, you can deal with only one word. Okay, this means that, you know, the one step of the previous algorithm can be done in, you know, as many clock cycle as the number of words in the multiplicand. Okay, so as I said before, you can choose any word length. I mean, that depends on your choice, the precision, area, and speed requirements. If you choose, you know, a larger word length, so this means that your processing unit is going to require more area. So this means that if you have more area, you can go for this kind of, you know, wide words. Okay, so let me give an idea how, you know, this multiplication or this, you know, the first step in the loop is performed on word basis. So let's assume that this is, you know, a typical processing unit that can implement this, the main loop. But this processing unit, you know, works on only one word of the multiplicand, the modulus and the partial result. But as you see here is that we only, you know, use one bit from the multiplier here. So this is why we call it a radix 2, you know, design, because you scan the multiplier one bit at a time in a clock cycle, not at a time. So what happens here is that after this operation is performed, you get a word here. So word size is denoted as W here. So, but of course, since in the second step of the loop, you have to shift it. So this means that you haven't got the jth word of the partial result yet. So you have to do one more, you know, processing using this processing unit. So this means that you get the next word from the, you know, multiplicand, you know, the modulus and the partial result, and then this is the, you know, AI it remains the same. And we get this. Okay, after we, because what happens here, just, you know, just be careful here. So the least significant bit of this guy goes to the most significant bit of this guy. And as a result of this operation, we got the jth word of the, you know, the new jth word of the updated jth word of the partial result in this case. So this means that we can start, you know, operating on the next bit of the multiplier. Of course, after two clock cycles. One clock cycle, we get it, and second clock cycles, and after two clock cycles, we can just, you know, go ahead and start. Of course, each, you know, we have different processing units here, okay? Each one is responsible for doing, you know, handling one bit of the multiplier in this case. Of course, once, you know, for example, this processing unit is done with this operation, it can start, you know, handling the another bit of the multiplier. So if you look at the dependency graph, this represents the operation this processing unit, you know, performs. So we start with the first bit of a multiplier, first word of multiplicand, and the, you know, the modulus, and partial result is the zero in the first clock cycle. What happens here is that we just do the same operation here, but this time with the second word of the multiplicand and the modulus, and then you can go on like this. After two clock cycle, you start, you know, working with A0, you can start working with A1, okay? So this means that this dependency graph shows that this, you know, operations can be pipelined, okay? You can have, for example, one vertical, you know, column here represent the, you know, the operation done by the same processing unit, okay? So this means that in this case, we have two processing units. So what is inside the processing unit? Two levels of what's called dual field headers. I mean, if you don't know what you don't know with dual field header, but you just imagine that, you know, this is kind of a full header, okay, for the time being. And the first layer is responsible for doing the first step of the loop, and the second layer is responsible of, you know, performing the second, you know, layer of the loop. And so here, there is one additional control, you know, signal here, what's called a field select control signal. What happens when you, you know, select different, you know, logical values for field select? For example, if F select is zero, what happens here is that, you know, imagine, you know, you have this dual field header as a kind of a enhanced full header. So this means that when f select is zero, so you suppress the carries, you don't compute the carries. When f select is one, so you compute the carries. So this is the only thing. So when f select is zero, so this means that you do operation in GF2, you know, field. And when f select is one, you do, you know, operation in GFP field. So this is very simple thing. So this is the inside of the dual field header. Anyone who knows the what a full header is, you see, you will see that this is not much different than the full header. It's almost the same. We have one, you know, additional control input here. So it's very simple, right? I mean, and it in terms of the time, the critical path delay, and in terms of the area, almost the same. Very, the difference is very negligible. Okay, so this means that you do not have, you know, one processing unit. You may have, you know, more than one processing unit. For example, it's a simple case when you have two processing units, meaning that two pipeline stages. Okay, so what you do here is that your operands are coming from RAM blocks. This is an important because RAM blocks are usually easier to implement in hardware. So processing unit is kind of, you know, operates on the bit of the multiplier and the words of the multiplicator and the modulus, and then it computes the partial results, and all these, you know, results are kind of forwarded to the next one. But of course, this pipeline might stall if you do not have, you know, sufficient number of processing units. So in this case, you will have, you know, an additional, you know, register, or again, you can devise a RAM block here instead of, you know, register. So here, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but this is our, you know, kind of computation. So if you do, for example, your pipeline stages is more than, you know, E is the number of words in the modulus. If it is more than this one, so actually you do not have any, you know, need for the extra register here. You then, you know, put some partial results when the pipeline stalls, meaning that the all the, you know, pipelines are kind of busy operating in the operands. Okay. So I will be gone, and this is how many number. You can just quantify the total computation time here in terms of word size, the precision, and the number of words in the modulus, and the number of stages in the design. So basically, if you have sufficient number of pipeline stages, there is no stall. So this means that basically, the number of clock cycles here to do one multiplication for 1024 bit modulus, it is twice the size of the price, the precision of the modulus here. But of course, you can do the same multiplication using fewer number, even one pipeline stage you can do it, but of course, the, you know, price is, you are going to pay in terms of the register space is going to increase, and then of course, the number of clock cycles is going to increase. So if you look at the processing unit implementation, this is kind of an old implementation, like 5-6 years ago we did it. So as you see here is that one processing unit, there is no actual penalty in the critical path delay, but there is very small overhead in the area because of this, not because of the dual field headers, but because of the we have to do some logic, we have to change some control logic, and also we have to do some shift and alignment layer. This is why, you know, it is a little bit, not because of the dual field header. What are the alternatives? The original algorithm is what is called a Radix 2 algorithm. We scan the, you know, bits of the, you know, one bit at a time in the multiplier. What you can do, you can just, you know, scan or handle, you know, the multiplier bits, two bits at a time or three bits at a time, and you can just increase, you know, if you have, of course, the area for this. And the result is that more complex design, probably lower clock frequency because the critical path delay is going to increase, and the higher area, this is kind of a, you know, expected result. But of course, what is going to happen here is that less clock cycle count, okay? So that is the important thing. So basically, if you do not have many, you know, gates, area, basically Radix 8 and Radix 2, if you just use this product of area time metric, they are equivalent. But if you have more area, for example, at least 25,000 NAND equivalent case, you will see that, you know, Radix 8 is going to outperform, you know, the Radix 2 design. Another interesting, you know, design, we also, you know, worked on this, you know, like a couple of years ago, it's called the dual Radix multiplier. So imagine what we are doing here. So we are doing the multiplication in GFP and GF2, But actually GF2 is not faster than GFP. But what we are, why we are using GF2? Because GF2 is faster, right? Simpler to design. In this case, in the dual radix multiply, what we do here is that we use radix 2 for GFP, radix 4 for GF2 to the K. So this means that in terms of the clock cycle count, you know, the multiplication in GF2 is twice faster than the multiplication in GFP mode. So, of course, we have some penalties, and this is the basic thing. And all we have to do here is that you have to, you know, pre-compute this value, and this means that additional register. So this means the area is going to increase. And we did some comparison. So here, A1 is the GFP only multiplier we implemented. A2 is single radix unified multiplier. A3 is dual radix multiplier, and we compared the performance of three of them using the product of area time. So actually A3 is slightly worse than A1 and A2 in GFP mode, like 7 to 19% depending on the precision, but A3 outperforms, you know, in terms of this metric by 38% to 46% in GF2 mode. So this means that dual radix, you know, the GF2 multiplication benefits from the dual radix multiplier. So the question here is that the final, you know, results, and the most recent result, is this really a unified arithmetic? So all we did just multiplication, and all we did actually, you know, repeated addition. Okay, is this unified? Can we do, for example, you know, other arithmetic operations like, you know, subtraction, comparison, in GFP mode, of course. Well, if you use carry-save notation, it is a little bit difficult to do that, because in carry-save, subtraction requires, you know, taking the 2's complement of the numbers and taking 2's complement of numbers. I don't know any, you know, efficient, you know, algorithm for this. It's kind of difficult because, you know, what we do here is that in the previous design, what we just multiply, get the result in redundant form, and then convert the result to redundant form after one multiplication. If you have 1,000 multiplication, like in the case of electric current cryptography, you have to do this transformation every time. So is this really a unified arithmetic? Well, so we kind of expanded our ideas, and basically we were using carry-save representation. This means that, you know, representing integers in GFP mode as a sum of two other integers like carry-save. But we said that subtraction is difficult in this case. What we can do, we can use another type of representation called redundant signed representation. This time, very simple thing. So instead of represent numbers of addition of two, sum of two other integers, you can just write any integer as a difference of two other integers. So what is the advantage of this? You can do very simple, you know, subtraction here. Hence, you can do, you know, relatively simple comparison operation.
But for equality. But for equality comparison.
For equality comparison. Yes, you are right. I mean, kind of, you know, comparison. You can, but in the case of, you know, carry-save, it's kind of difficult to do that.
No.
Okay, so what we gain from here, we can do other operations. For example, we can do subtraction. And imagine the binary inversion algorithm. We can do binary inversion algorithm because binary inversion algorithm or Montgomery inversion algorithms, you know, is using addition and subtraction, comparison, and etc. So when we use redundant signed logic here, as I said, the representation, we can do, you know, for example, inversion operation, multiplicative inversion operation. So another thing is that you do not have to do the transformation every time you do multiplication. You can stay in the non-redundant representation as long as you want. Okay? So once you are done with the computation, so you can just go back to the, you know, the non-redundant representation if it is required, if it is what is asked for. So basically this is, if we have redundant signed arithmetic, we can just support, you know, ternary field arithmetic as well. Okay? So this is how you do, you know, how this is the data path of the unified, you know, the adder for 1 bit. Okay? These circles represent basically full adders, kind of what's called the generalized full adders, but these are not more complicated than full adders, actually, they are the same. And only addition logic is this one. Of course, it comes with a penalty, right? Because we support the three types of, you know, operation in the three types of fields in the same data path. And this is the additional, you know, logic we are going to use. And there is one XOR and there is one multiplexer here. So compared to this four errors. Okay, so we did some analysis in this case. Okay, so these are the architectures that we have done so far. This is A1 is the GFP only architecture, A2 is GF2 only architecture, A3 is GF3 only architectures. A4 is unified architecture, supporting these two fields. A5 is unified architecture supporting three fields. Okay, so when I say A1 plus A2, this means that the hypothetical machine that have two separate data path for GFP and GF2K. Okay, so this is how we are going to compare these different architectures. So again, the metric is area, the product of area time. So if you just compare the A4, A4 is the unified the module for the architecture for the GFP and GF2. So if you compare it to a hypothetical machine or architecture where you have two separate data path for GFP and GF2, you will have 7% performance using this metric. But if you compare your A5, meaning that unified architecture for supporting three fields over this hypothetical architecture, you get 3.33% improvement in terms of this metric again. But of course, what you can do unified architecture for GFP, GF2 plus GF3. Is it necessary to kind of unify GF3 arithmetic into the old-fashioned unified arithmetic? Yes, and this is the, when you compare, you will get this 28% improvement. So this is the implementation results. So this is, you can use different, this is the we just implement the multiplication unit here. If you use four processing unit, this is the timing results you get for 160 bit ECC, 1024 RSA, and tape pairing for this field. These are comparable, they are providing comparable the security level. Of course, this is kind of a bit serial architecture, so we didn't aim to come up with the best tape pairing algorithm ever or best RSA algorithm ever. So this means that, as you see here, is that we can use very fast clock here, 2.38, because of this. This is just Radix 2 implementation, okay? Just to show that, well, this unified arithmetic really works. Okay, so these are, when you look at the tape pairing operation, it's kind of comparable to the, to the FDQR operation. And so the area requirements are kind of comparatively low. Research directions. So all I talk about is cryptographic accelerator. What you can do, you can embed these unified architectures into common general purpose processors. So you can provide, for example, some additional instructions for doing arithmetic or for kind of easing, just speeding up the arithmetic in different fields. You can do unified inversion using RST, and it's kind of a trivial extension of GFP inversion using RST. And you can have unified architectures for other public key crypto algorithms that support other public key crypto algorithms. Okay, basically, this is what I'm going to say, and this is the end of my talk. If you have a question, I would be happy to answer your questions.
Just a question. At the beginning of the talk, you mentioned how cryptography can achieve security levels of much shorter keys. Now, in these new schemes, at least the tape pairing,
yeah.
I've got a feeling you might.
Well, actually, I don't get your question. Can you repeat that?
These new schemes that use the tape pairing.
Yeah.
It looks like you might be able to use that pairing also to reduce the discrete log problem in the curves to the discrete log problem in the field. In which case, you would have more efficient algorithms for solving it. So my question basically is whether you might have to go back to longer keys again if you use that particular type of
but basically, we are using the same field for the elliptic curves. Are we within the tracks? I don't know the answer to this question. So
perhaps I can help also.
Because
I think there's a little bit of misunderstanding here. what Erica was presenting was that you have unified architectures supporting three different kinds of arithmetic and thereby facilitating higher level operations and primitive structures and so on, but you're not really solving the elliptic or introducing ID-based or pairings, for example, for making it a recursive path. So they're essentially different, I mean, they're separately used or separately supported.
Yeah, basically it is, because when I say GF to the power of 160, we are not using this, you know, this elliptic curve for the tape pairing. So this is what you are asking, right?
Yeah, I'm just generally, do you need longer keys for the tape pairing algorithms as opposed to just the traditional algorithm?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yes, of course.
And the architecture supports very scalable, therefore you collaborate with this, that's right. But the architecture is scalable so that regardless of whether you're running 160-bit DCC or typically use like several thousand bits for ID-based systems. And so we can also support the same architecture, the same data path, without increasing, by just iterating more the ID-based systems.
Yeah, that's good. Any other question?
Can you elaborate what that would be for hyper curves?
Well, you know, usually in hyper curves you are using a smaller field. I mean, you can use this, you know, here for hyperelliptic curves, because when I say cryptography, usually we didn't do it. We didn't do any, you know, calculations for hyperelliptic curve, but, you know, the, you know, using this unified, you know, hyperelliptic curve cryptography, I think it's kind of okay. I mean, you can